Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
It's got a question mark because I'm not sure that we always know what's in our student contract. So this is more about knowing what you've promised than delivering on the promises to some extent, but of course the two come along together. Students receive information about courses from a lot of different sources. And now we're having to manage student expectations more and make sure that we're giving students what they think they're getting. It's important that we understand how the promises we've made are going to be legally enforceable. Now, of course, the questions about student contracts and the issues around student contracts are not new ones. They've been around for an awfully long time. And we've had some goes with greater or lesser success of producing a comprehensive contract for students. But the reality is that for most students, the terms that go into their contract come from a range of different sources. And what's important for you going forward is to understand how those sources are incorporated into the student contract and how the students know what they can reasonably expect from you as institutions. And why does it matter now? Why is now a good time to look again at what we do in terms of contracting with students? I think it's back to the context, which is very similar to the context that Julia's already taken you through, because we're living in an environment where things are changing for higher education. So despite the fact that parts of the government higher education white paper have been delayed, we're not looking at the opening up of degree awarding powers in the way that was suggested until at least after 2015, we are still having the changes to the way in which students receive information, the growth in the amount of information for students, the restructuring that information to try and get some commonality across the sector, with the idea that that will then drive choice, that there will be more of a market for higher education, that students will be able, from the information they get, to decide what each different institution is going to give them. And you as institutions need to know what you're promising to give and what students can then say, well, actually, if I don't get that, then I'm entitled to complain about it. Because, of course, fees, and Sally Hunt's comment, more bang for the extra bucks, comments made earlier on about parents saying, well, I'm paying more. I reasonably expect that I'm going to get more because I'm paying more. Again, makes it important that we've set out exactly what the student can expect from our institution. Because if you don't know what the expectations are and what they can reasonably expect and what you've agreed to give, that's where you're going to face challenges from students. So it's important that we really tie this down. And it does lead on to my last point, is can we reasonably expect to see more challenge from students who don't think that they're getting what their institutions have promised them? Now, there was the expectation when the original fees were introduced that that would lead to an explosion in litigation, and we all rolled up our sleeves and rubbed our hands in glee at the thought that there was going to be more work, and that didn't materialise. And I'm not convinced that actually we will see a lot more litigation as a result of the increase in fees. But I think that we will see more complaints, more internal work for institutions, more references to the Office of the Independent Adjudicator. So it's still, even if you're not ending up in court, there is still a need to make sure that we're getting it right and that when a student says, well, why haven't you delivered X, we've got some way of saying, well, we were never going to. We never promised that. It wasn't reasonable for you to expect us to deliver it. And to go back to the title of this conference, is the relationship with students a contract or a partnership? From a legal point of view, we are very confident to say, no, it's a contract. It's not a partnership. But it's not a contract in the sense of a contract that you'd expect, say, if you were going to a normal retail environment. You don't go in to the university and enter into the contract and expect to get a degree at the end. It is a very much a two-way process. So students have obligations, and they have their side of the bargain to keep if they're going to get what they expect from coming to university. But there's little doubt, and I think it's quite sort of trite law now, that the relationship between the university and a student is a contractual relationship, and it's a consumer contract. But again, not consumer in the sense of, you know, you go to Tesco's and buy a tin of beans. You reasonably expect when you pay your money you're going to get a tin of beans. Student relationship doesn't work like that. But your student contract should set out what you as institutions are promising to deliver, but it also should set out what you expect the students to do in order to get the ultimate outcome. So to get that, all the things that Julia listed out the students are looking for, and particularly that outcome which gives them the opportunity to go on to a professional career, they need to know what they have to do to achieve that, as well as what you're going to provide to them. And then, because it's a consumer contract, you have to bear in mind that the obligation under the contract from you as institutions is that you will act fairly and reasonably. That's where the consumer element comes into it. And what that means is if you're going to include or want to include in what you're doing terms that are onerous or unusual, you need to make sure that the students know about them and really make sure that they've had an opportunity to understand what you're requiring of them and saying to them. So it's definitely a contract, but it's a partnership in the sense that it's a two-way contract. So you're not as institutions simply delivering and providing things to them. The students have to play their part too to get their contractual outcome. So what does a student contract do? Well, it's got to provide prospective students with an accurate description of life at your institution on the particular course that they're doing, on a work placement if they go on one, living in the halls of residence if they're living in your accommodation. And in practice, that's not likely to be a single contract. It's going to be a whole series of different contracts that actually might arise at different times through the relationship. So you'll have the start off individual coming into the institution. You'd expect them to be bound by some basic terms and conditions when they arrive, some basic promises for what the institution is going to deliver, and some basic expectations for what the students are going to do. And that will relate to the course that they enrol onto. Work placements may come up later, so it may be that it's not an integral part of the course, but it's something that you would encourage students to undertake. And actually, they might sign up to that contract later on. But again, it still will be a set of promises. What are you going to deliver to the student, and what do you expect them to do in that context? And we might have another party in that contract as well. We'll have the placement provider, and we need to understand what the relationship between the student and the placement provider and the institution and the placement provider are too. I mean, it might be yet another contract. And of course, if you're providing halls of residence, then that will be a separate contract, accommodation contract that sets out what individuals can reasonably expect to get from their accommodation. Because these are students, but actually would advocate it for any contract, the contract needs to be in plain and clear language that the students are likely to be able to understand. Because if they can't understand it, it's less likely that a court, because that's where we always end up with contracts. Contracts are defensive documents. They're fine until you have to litigate on them. So it's only when you get into a point of dispute that the terms of the contract really matter. If you don't have a dispute, it doesn't matter what the contract says because everybody works through and we're all quite happy about it. So you're always defensively producing contracts to deal with when there's a dispute with an individual. So plain and clear language so that everybody understands what they're expected to do and what you're expected to give to them. So where are your promises and what has been promised? How can you be clear that you know where the promises are? Promises are made in various documents. So you'll start off with the first contact between the university and the institution is quite likely to be obtaining a prospectus or possibly looking at programme guides, which are probably on your website. Now, quite a lot of prospectuses will have some kind of disclaimer at the back that says the things we say in our prospectus are not binding on us. Programme guides, not so much, because if you're going to set out what's going to be available in the programme, then individuals can reasonably expect what you tell them that your programme's going to contain is actually right and accurate. So it may be that those initial documents that they look at in starting to make that decision about which institution they'll come to may well be the initial terms of your contract, so the promises for what you're going to deliver to the institution. But the prospectus and other information that you include on your website will include other promises about what you deliver. And there's a difference, of course, between the general statements about how useful, nice your institution is, how much they might enjoy coming here, which is very unlikely that a court would ever say if somebody complained that they hadn't enjoyed the institution as much as you suggested on your website or on your prospectus that they ought to, that they hadn't had a great learning experience. It's not that likely that that would result in compensation, although it's possible. There's one case, quite an old case now, where an individual signed up for a car repair course, actually, at an FE college. And the course, what they did to undertake the course was they brought to the college, one of these students, a lovely vintage car, which during the course of their learning, they dismantled. Unfortunately, at the end of the course, it turned out that they didn't know how to put it back together again. And the individual was awarded compensation not only for the fact that the course wasn't effective, but also because they lost the enjoyment they could reasonably expect from education. So it is possible, although it's not a great authority, but it's there, but it would be possible if students had a less enjoyable experience than they could reasonably have expected because you didn't deliver to expectations, that they might be able to recover compensation for that. So what you say in your prospectuses and programme guides needs to be very carefully considered, and you need to be very clear that you can deliver what you're saying in there, because that's the start of your students' expectations and the start of their understanding of what you're promising to give to them. And that pitch is now being, the information available is going to be increased, of course, with the introduction of key information sets. There's a lot of the information, I think, in key information sets which couldn't possibly form any logical basis for a contract. But things about fees and the amount of teaching and learning and the mix of teaching and learning on the course and the assessment methods might well be something that they might argue that they relied on in making a decision to come on your course. The wider information sets, information about strategy, student survey, student satisfaction, your teaching and learning strategy, all of which are suggested to be types of information that ought to be available. I think less likely to be contractual terms, but teaching and learning strategy might be if you radically change the strategy, and again, they relied on that in deciding to come to your institution. I think you have to be aware of open days and what academics might say in open days as well, because academics do at times like to be very encouraging to students and may make all kinds of promises and guarantees about what they'll be able to deliver that are not really what you would intend to be the case. And because your contracts tend not to be in single documents, you won't necessarily have excluded those sort of oral representations, and no reason why it's part of building up the terms of a contract that oral promises can't be made. So academics probably need some guidance around what they can realistically say to people at open days. What else might be contractual? I've included student charters. Now, I understand that the intention is that student charters won't be contractual documents. They'll be a set of sort of mutual expectations set out within a short document that gives the student effectively an entry gateway into understanding what the institution's all about. I think because when I look at student charters, you have your entry gateways, and then they'll link back to the things that you probably do want to include in your contract, like the rules and regulations of the institution, procedures. So you might say if you've got a complaint, then you need to you use your complaints procedure. Or might say something like, we have a very comprehensive procedure for dealing with complaints, and then if you want to look at the complaints procedure, use this link. And I think if you go from charter to links of terms and conditions which you would intend the parties to have to comply with, then you're starting to bring the student charter into the contractual world. So I think student charters need to be very carefully written on the assumption that there's at least a reasonable possibility that there might be some contractual force in them. So student charter might be part of the overall terms and conditions, along with your rules and regulations and procedures, which will generally be available on your website. Terms of a contract are the things that are incorporated into the contract before the contract is agreed. And the way contracts are made is you have an offer, acceptance, consideration, which is usually money, and an intention for the parties to be bound by it. Now, the way you make a contract is you make an offer to a student, which the student accepts. When the student accepts, that's when you get a binding contract. And what you have to ensure as institutions is that all those expectations and the promises that you want to make to students and the obligations that you want to place on them have been brought to their attention before they accept the offer. Because if you only tell them about the rules and regulations and your policies once they're enrolling at the institution, actually it's too late, the contract's made, and you won't necessarily have incorporated those terms into the contract. So it's very important for those things that set student expectations, these are things we expect of you, these are the things we're going to deliver, that they're brought to the student's attention before they accept the offer of a place. And then just keeping your promises, just would you have a single comprehensive contract? We did have a jolly good go at one point, the lawyers, at producing a single comprehensive contract. And we would always say, for security's sake, if you put everything in one place, make it absolutely clear that all the information that students can rely on are in a single document, then from a legal point of view, that's much easier to manage. I don't think it's remotely realistic for institutions to do that, because you'd have to have a big book that included all your rules and regulations and all the rest of it. It would have lots of nice exclusion clauses and limitations on liability and all the rest of it. And I don't think that it's ever going to be acceptable or sensible to expect students to be able to understand and work with a contract that's written in very technical legal language. And certainly when it was tried, it was hugely unpopular. So I think the reality is that you will continue to have a range of different documents which link together to set out the terms of your contract. And it's really important, I think, at this stage, with the changes and the increase in funding and the greater risk of complaint and people being keener to make sure that they get what they're paying for, that you do have a look at your terms and conditions, that you understand what you're promising students, where those promises are made, which contracts you think are your contractual documents that you would want the students to be bound by, and that you make sure that the students see them or have a good opportunity to see them before they accept their offers of places. It's a bit like when you're buying your apps from the app store, and you have to tick that box to say, I've read the terms and conditions. I bet not very many of us do. And to some extent for students it's the same position. It doesn't matter if they read them, so long as you've brought them to their attention and they've had a reasonable opportunity to read them. Save, I say, if there's anything particularly unusual or onerous, then you ought to make a bit more effort to make sure that they know about them. And if you don't get it right, what happens? As I say, the doomsayers have suggested that there are going to be lots more litigation. I still think that that's unlikely, but I do think that we've seen the growth in complaints to the Office of the Independent Adjudicator, and obviously this is a neat lead into the next speaker. But I think that there's no reason to suppose that that's particularly going to get less, and I think there will be more individuals raising issues through the institution's internal processes and then on to the Office of the Independent Adjudicator. It's free. So if you've got a complaint and you're not happy with what your institution's telling you, it's the obvious place to go. Going to the courts is fine, but it's expensive. So you've got to pay your own costs or do it yourself, and you take the risk that you're going to have to pay the other side's costs if you lose. And I think if you've spent a lot of money on a course that you didn't think delivered what you wanted it to, it will be in relatively rare occasions where the cost of litigation is actually worthwhile. You can also complain to the QAA, and the QAA complaints process seems to be changing, so we wait to see quite what that's going to look like. And again, I'll speak this afternoon, maybe I'll tell us more about that. Because it's a consumer contract, if your contracts are unsatisfactory, the Office of Fair Trading can look at them. Again, relatively unusual, but it would only look at the fairness of the contractual terms. So very important that you've got your complaints procedures right, that it's robust, that you know how to follow them, and that you start to manage and monitor your student complaints so you can identify areas where expectations are not being met and either change the promises you make or make sure that what you're doing does meet what's needed. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.